talked about renewing our mind and discussed brain strain and our health. And we looked at the new brain science and how it dovetails with God's plan to promote emotionally balanced living in our chaotic world. And we also considered how toxic thoughts can be the roadblock to our health. So now in the next session, we're going to look at restarting our body, because we need to also implement strategies to sustain our health. Now, needless to say, it's next to impossible to cover this topic in 45 minutes. And I have so much material, it's ridiculous. So we'll just bop around and hopefully do all right here in the next time. But what I want to say is that I was fascinated because just last week, I read a study that came out in January of this year, only a month ago, from the Journal of the American College of Cardiologists, which found that a healthy lifestyle, in fact, might prevent coronary heart disease in nearly 75% of the women in the study. And this was no shabby study. There were 88,000 women that they studied for 20 years. So our topic of a healthy lifestyle is really, really important, especially since heart disease is the number one killer of women. I hope you all know that here. That's not new news. Yesterday was Wear Red, right, for heart. Well, sleep problems affect at least 30% of Americans. 30% of Americans complain of some type of sleep disruption. So if you have sleep disruption, you're not alone. And in fact, even the Apostle Paul complained about it. So there you have it. But 10% of people actually have symptoms that affect them during the day, their productivity and their ability to stay on task and to enjoy life and to do their work. And the people who are most affected are new mothers, menopausal women, older men and women, and shift workers. So that is almost everybody. You're right. It's almost everybody. So, and the statistics bear it out, because Americans now spend over $750 million on over-the-counter sleep aids. However, they spend about $2 billion, with a B, on prescription sleeping pills. So that is huge. And there are three factors that affect when we fall asleep. One is circadian rhythm, one is environmental arousal, and one is sleep deprivation. Now, I'm glad I'm not doing this after lunch. Of course, I am speaking to you after lunch, and I'm getting very nervous. However, as you can see, there are two drives that are competing to either keep us awake or put us to sleep. And the one is the circadian arousal system, and the other is the homeostatic sleep drive. Okay, so here's the circadian arousal system and the homeostatic sleep curve. And you can see that they intersect around 2 or 3 in the afternoon. They flatline. So how many have that feeling after lunch? Me too, and I have to give the lecture. However, it can vary per person. Everybody has a little bit different, but in general, that's where it flatlines in the afternoon. And most of us tend to fight against it, right? Have another cup of coffee or a cup of tea, keep moving, and so forth. But that nap zone is when the two drives are pretty much flatlined. However, interestingly enough, they did a study at NASA where pilots were given time to take a 26-minute nap during that time, 26 minutes, and it improved their performance by 34%. And if they took the nap for 45 minutes, it improved their performance for 6 hours. So try to tell your employer that. I don't think they'd go along with it. However, I just throw it out there for those of you who have the capability. Now, that doesn't mean sleep for 2 hours. No, no. We know people that just like to, you know, get in bed and sleep the afternoon away. And that is going to throw off your sleep if you take naps. So don't take this the wrong way. If you take a nap for a long period of time, it will affect your sleep at night. I'm talking a short nap. And when we're sleeping, you know, our brains are not really asleep. What happens to our brains is they're actually reviewing what's gone on in our day so far. So maybe I should say, quick, go to sleep. you can review everything that we went over this morning. And they found that with mice or rats, I'm not sure which one, in particular, where they taught them how to go through a maze, and they woke them up in the middle of it, of a REM sleep, and the ones that they woke up, they totally forgot how to do the maze. So, I mean, I know we're not mice or rats, but I mean, that's what they found. So I just throw it out there. Anyway, the three things that primarily affect the circadian rhythm are jet lag and shift work, and the secretion of melatonin. And melatonin is a hormone that is secreted in our bodies from our pineal gland in the brain, and when darkness occurs, it turns on this nerve from the retina of our eyes, and melatonin gets secreted, and when it goes up, it makes us feel tired. And that rhythm is easily disrupted, like I said, by jet lag. Have any of you noticed that, if you've flown across time zones and so forth, that it's like incredible? For me, anyway, when I fly across the time zones, it takes me several days to get myself back on course. And a good way that I have found to really help that is to use a sublingual spray of melatonin about an hour before the new bedtime, and use that, and this really, really helps you to be able to just reset your clock. A spray solution actually does work a lot better than a pill, although a pill can work as well too. It takes a little bit longer. But if you use a melatonin spray about an hour before you go to bed, that can really help reset your clock.
How much are you getting as happens with a pill? 3 grams, 5 grams, 10 grams?
Yeah, you get 3 milligrams on a spray. Yeah, so you get 3 milligrams on a spray. Noel, you can just spray, it doesn't act, I said sublingual, but actually you don't have to spray it sublingual, just spray it in your mouth. Just spray it in your mouth. It gets absorbed through your tongue and you know, through the blood vessels. I gotta move back. Through the blood vessels in your mouth. So it bypasses your gut and you get it much, much faster. Shift workers, like I said, there's been lots of studies. I can't really go into them all, but just suffice it to say that shift workers are really affected as well. So similarly, an hour before the bedtime, if you spray melatonin, it should help to get that going and turn off the cortisol. Well, these are some of the things that impact going to sleep as well. And obviously, anything that causes environmental arousal, from arguments to stressful conversations to night sweats to caffeine, Caffeine stays with you for a long time. There's 100 milligrams of caffeine in a cup of coffee, and only about half of it gets absorbed within 6 hours. The other half will hang around in your body. Can we wait till the end? But
yes.
Okay. So it's really important. Not everyone is caffeine sensitive. It's the same thing as the hormones. Not everyone is hormone sensitive. But for those people who are caffeine sensitive, it's really something to bear in mind. So again, one of the ways to help bypass this environmental arousal is to take some time before you go to bed at night and do some journaling. And I talked to some people over the break, and they mentioned that they had had some trouble journaling in the past, and I can appreciate that, because, you know, if you look at a blank book, you're like, okay, now, what am I going to say? You know, and it's a little bit difficult. So what I tried to do is to structure the journaling process, and I have questions for you to think about, to answer. Based on the fruit of the spirit, it gives you a chance to really quiet your mind, sort out your day, and do that. So if you have problems with sleeping, it's always better to not lay there trying to solve all the problems of the day, but to write them down instead. Sleep deprivation is another key problem, and it can really affect you. And new mothers, believe it or not, lose an average of 700 hours of sleep in the first year. That's a lot of sleep. That's equivalent to 29 days plus. So if you are a new mother, if you know new mothers, help them out any way you can, because when you have sleep deprivation, it can lead from anything from irritability all the way up to psychosis. And in fact, during the war, if you were around during World War II, any of you might know that the Soviet KGB, as well as the Japanese, used sleep deprivation techniques on their prisoners for torture. So sleep deprivation is a big area. Now, one way that you can help yourself is to keep a sleep diary. And I think I wrote that in your workbook. I don't know. Did I put that down? Some thoughts that you can think about? Because if you have to go to a healthcare provider, you're going to need some information to bring there. You know, you just say, oh, I can't sleep, or I'm waking up at night. Well, yes, you are, but if you can give some more detail, that's always helpful. So these are some of the things that you want to document, how you fatigued you feel in the daytime, how many minutes you are spending napping, what kind of medications you use, the time you first tried to go to sleep, how long it took you to fall asleep, and then how many times you woke up, and your final waking time, and how many total hours did you sleep, and the quality of your sleep, and how refreshed did you feel in the morning. So these are all things that you want to think about and record, so that if you have to go and get some extra help, you'll have some information to give. It's important to keep in mind, though, that there's underlying problems that can also impact your sleep. And some of them are if you have a mood disorder of some sort, if you have depression, mood swings, anxiety, that can impact your sleep. You might have a medical diagnosis that can impact your sleep. Do you have restless leg syndrome or other increased movements during sleep? Or maybe you snore or have sleep apnea. Ask your sleeping buddy about that. You probably don't know if you snore. But these things can all impact your sleep. And then medications, besides caffeine, other stimulants, cortisone, allergy medications, cough medicines, those kinds of things, heart medicines, they can all affect your sleep. right? So you need to be aware of all of that. So there's lots of different ways that you can address chronic insomnia, and we can't really go into them all, but the American Academy of Sleep Medicine published a comprehensive literature review of the different treatments for insomnia, and stimulus control therapy was on their list, and I'm going to talk about that briefly. I'm not going to talk about relaxation training because we already spoke about that a little bit last time. Cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, we talked a little bit about that in the last session when we talked about cognitive distortions, but this is therapy that directly relates to your sleep. And then also good hygiene and resetting your physiological clock. So those are some of the non-drug approaches. And here we have Peppermint Patty, I guess. This is what not to do. So she and Charlie Brown looks like he's doing fine and sleeping away there, and she's pestering him saying, "I did what you said, big brother. I've been worrying about everything. I even worried about you. I worried that you'll never amount to anything and that you'll marry the wrong girl and all your kids will be stupid." Then she says, "Well, I think I'm starting to get a little sleepy." And he says, "I guess I'll just lie here and worry." So that's not what to do. But anyway, in stimulus control therapy, what you want to do is you want to break the association of bed with wakefulness. And this is really good if you do have anxious thoughts. And the idea is you don't want to go to bed until you're sleepy. Don't just say, "Well, it's 11 o'clock, time for bed." Well, maybe you're not sleepy at 11, right? So you wait to go to bed until you're sleepy. You remain in bed about 10 minutes. Without sleeping, if you don't sleep in 10 minutes, get up. Don't just lay there and toss and turn. Get up and do something boring. Maybe it's the laundry, I don't know. I don't know what's boring to you, but what's ever boring, figure it out and do it. And then only return to bed when you're sleepy. Now the key is you have to maintain a regular wake-up time. So if your wake-up time is 7, then don't matter. If you're not going to sleep till 2, you gotta get up at 7. Don't be getting up at 10. No. So that is what stimulus control therapy is. You're breaking the association of bed with wakefulness, and you're also doing some sleep deprivation, so eventually you'll reset your clock. And about 70% of people are helped by that type of therapy. Okay. And we talked already about cognitive behavioral therapy. It's just very important that you find somebody who does this type of therapy. It could be a licensed person, either a nurse or a psychologist or a social worker or somebody who specializes in cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. And they'll do a good assessment on some of the things I just spoke about, as well as telling you to keep a sleep diary and reframe any of your dysfunctional beliefs about sleep. It'll be interesting because a lot of people say, "Well, when I can't sleep, I can't do this and this and this and this." All right? Well, that, again, is a cognitive distortion, because the therapist will point out, "Well, listen, you told me on such and such a day you, in fact, did do whatever it is that you said you can't do. So in fact, you are doing it." And then you'll learn some relaxation techniques under some supervision. And there shows about a 90% improvement. Most people know about sleep hygiene and all the different things you can do to stop, to set the mood for going to sleep, right? Don't exercise before you go to bed and things like that. Develop a relaxing evening routine. and so forth. But one thing I wanted to point out to you is, I don't know, does anyone here know about flux? Anybody know about flux? F dot L-U-X? And what it does is it makes the color of your screen adapt to the time of day. Many of us are using cell phones, tablets, and computers. And they look like the sunlight. Even if you turn it down, it looks like the sunlight. And so what that does is it prevents the melatonin from being released in your brain. So what flux does is it automatically resets the screen color to your room. And it's really, really very, very good program. And it's for free. And it's available for Mac OS X and Windows and Linux and iPhone and iPad. And you can get it on the internet. So that's basically what I want to say about sleep hygiene. And then these are some of the over-the-counter sleep aids. And most of the ones like the Tylenol PM and Z-Quil and Unisom and other ones like that, they all contain diphenhydramine, which is an antihistamine. And they work well enough, you know, but they can cause daytime drowsiness. Has anybody experienced that with that? Yeah. Yes, exactly. And you can also develop tolerance to it as well. So, I mean, it has its place sometimes, but, you know, whatever. And then I already talked to you about melatonin. That's a really good option. There's other options for valerian, which is an herb. But generally speaking, that's better used when you're coming off a prescription sleeping pill. And then there's prescription sleeping pills that help you fall asleep, and there's ones that help you stay asleep. All right, and there's some new ones out as well. And then some of the older antidepressants, some of the primary care doctors are using them for their side effects for sleep. They're not really a sleep medicine, but they use it, such as trazodone, something called trazodone. And it's actually an antidepressant, but in a lower dose, what it does is it makes you sleepy. So that helps for some people as well.
Excuse me. I had a few friends who were on Ambien.
Right.
And they had hallucinations.
Right. And that
so
can do.
I would never touch that myself.
Right. Well, it's always important to, when you're starting a sleep medication, always start it on a day that you don't have to do something the next day. That is like the cardinal rule. Don't ever start it on a day that you have to do something the next day, because you don't know how your body's going to react, and everybody reacts differently. Okay? So just bear that in mind, and that's a good point that you made. So here's some biblical thoughts about insomnia. David had a down pat where he said, meditate within your heart on your bed and be still. And again, if you practice relaxation techniques, including mindfulness breathing, progressive muscle relaxation, reciting memorized scriptures, and prayer can all be helpful. Now, we didn't go into progressive muscle relaxation, but honestly, that's a really good relaxation technique to use before you go to sleep, because a lot of us have tense muscles that we don't even know are tense. So once you get an idea of what your muscles feel like when they're tensed and when they're not tensed, you can relax them, and that will help you to just let go. You combine that with some relaxation breathing and any other techniques that you use. Progressive muscle relaxation is just like starting from the top of your head all the way down to your feet and basically just wrinkling the muscles up, you know, tightening them up really tight, tighten your forehead, and then relax it. And hold each thing for about 5 seconds or so. And then you'll really get that feeling, especially in your face, your neck. Try to just tense it up as tense as you can, your shoulders, and then relax them. And just let it come out. Another good way is to remember songs in the night. That's what David said. And he says, I call to remembrance my song in the night. I meditate within my heart, and my spirit makes diligent search. And if you have a cell phone or a tablet, I don't know if any of you have tried this or done this, but it works very well. And you can just use your earphones to help you listen or meditate on some quiet hymns and really reflect upon the Lord. And that will really help to bring your mind into that quiet and calm that we talked about in the first session. One night I plugged in the book of Romans, and I ended up going through the whole book of Romans being read to me in the night before I fell asleep. But hey, there's more than one way to read through the Bible, right? So anyway, whatever works for you, just try it. And I know my grandfather used to always say, when he woke up in the middle of the night, he used to always just start to pray. And he would pray, and he eventually would fall asleep. And it would just calm and quiet his soul. So there's lots of different techniques that you can use. Now we're going to talk about hormones real quickly. And you can see all over a woman's brain are receptor sites for estrogen and progesterone. And God designed and organized a woman's brain biochemistry to be highly receptive to hormones. Hormones are actually the fuel that activates a woman's unique brain circuits that results in those typical female behaviors and skills. They determine what the brain is interested in doing, and they guide our social and our sexual interactions as well as our aggressive behaviors. They influence us about worrying and hurting somebody's feelings, or being optimistic or pessimistic, joyful or tearful, self-doubt or self-confidence. And your reality can actually change throughout your menstrual cycle based on what your hormones are up to. And as I said earlier, as your hormones decline, what happens is chronic debilitating diseases go up. So that's something to bear in mind. And from the moment that the ovaries spring into action as an adolescent, it's like a whole orchestra begins to play in our brains. And the piece of music could be a beautiful symphony, or it could be totally discordant. So, and out of tune. Now, I know this slide is out of focus, but I just wanted to show you how the hormones just burst into life here at the beginning of adolescence. They go from way down here to shoo, and the top line is estrogen, the purple line, and the dotted line is progesterone. And pretty much through your fertility years, although there are variations in the monthly cycle, they stay constant. But when a woman reaches perimenopause, which can start as early as their 30s, which most gals in their 30s are not thinking about perimenopause, it's the furthest thing from their mind. But in fact, what happens is the estrogen stays pretty high, but the progesterone starts bottoming out. Bottoming out. I think I'm getting too close to this thing. Bottoming out. And that gap really impacts a woman's feelings and moods, and they start to have that change in moods going on. And then we move into menopause and postmenopause, which I'll talk about that in a minute. So what happens is when that discrepancy starts occurring, you can see that the estrogen drops about, 35% between age 35 and 50, but the progesterone drops 75%. And so there's this whole discrepancy that's going on between your progesterone and estrogen. And it can cause all kinds of problems, with irregular periods or heavy bleeding, out of control cycles, and many different problems it can cause. And so it's important to consider supplementing with some type of progesterone during that time period, because you can see that it just can really throw everything out. Because on top of it all, we live in a world that we have xenoestrogens, which are coming from the environment, and that just makes our estrogen even higher. So we need to be thinking about that kind of thing. This I show you just to say that women have two times the amount of depression than men do, but it mainly occurs during those reproductive years, from here, from adolescence to the 50s. And as soon as the hormones balance out again, the levels change. So when we say that women have twice the rate of depression as men, that generally occurs during those reproductive years. So this is what happens during a normal cycle. You can see that it starts out with estrogen climbing and progesterone being very low. And this estrogen kind of gives you the feeling of being more social and relaxed during the first 2 weeks of your period, right? And then you have an increased sex drive and your verbal skills are good and all that kind of stuff. And then what happens is the estrogen starts to drop and progesterone starts kicking in like a weed killer, literally, and it reverses what the estrogen did. So they kind of work together. It just goes along and reverses all those actions. The brain becomes sedated. It becomes less focused in the second 2 weeks of your period. And then what happens is the progesterone bottoms out the few days before your period, and that is when some women who are hormone sensitive just can't cope anymore. So that gives you a basic idea of what happens during that time period. You might find yourself crying even over a TV commercial. Who knows? but relationships suffer, and the oxytocin and the dopamine bottom out, and cortisol takes over, and you really run into emotional trouble. Now, you probably have heard of PMS or PMDD. Has anybody heard of PMDD? I just found this out the other day, that a lot of women don't realize what PMDD is. But about 75% of women experience some kind of premenstrual change in their emotional or their physical symptoms, and that's called PMS, right? We're pretty much all aware of that. But about 3 to 9% experience a moderate to severe premenstrual mood symptoms, and that's known as premenstrual dysphoric disorder, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, or PMDD. And that is generally more severe, and it affects more mood symptoms. The thing about this is it has to last. What am I putting here? Oh, these are some of the physical symptoms. What are some? Well, I should ask you, but it takes too long to be doing this, and I'm getting nervous about the time. But think about the physical symptoms that you might have before you have your period. All right? Do any of them sound familiar? So, the bloating, sometimes hot flashes, fatigue, right? And then you have emotional symptoms, irritability, depression, tearfulness, anxiety, nervousness, etc., etc. And then you have behavioral symptoms. Food cravings, you ever have that? Eating everything in sight, get the ice cream out, and so forth. So, but anyway, a lower sex drive, slower thinking. So What happens with PMDD is you have to have more than five symptoms every month with more than one mood symptom. This is very important, and it must be confirmed by a prospective daily rating for at least 2 months. Now, I don't know where that paper went. Is it coming around, the mood and symptom tracker? Okay, everybody got a chance to at least take a glance at it. Okay, you can download this off the website for free. Yep. Anyway, and feel free to use it and take it to your healthcare provider if you feel the need to, and really track your symptoms and see how they're looking. Because sometimes, you know, you have a general feeling about how you feel, but you're really not tracking it in a very concrete kind of way. So by doing that, it will allow you to have a better sense of how you're doing. But to have PMDD, those symptoms have to occur in the last 2 weeks of your period, not just any old time. Because if they're occurring earlier in your cycle, then you probably have some other kind of a mood disorder. So this is mommy moods, and it may represent a subset of women who are mood sensitive to hormonal fluctuations. Not everybody has mommy moods, but a lot of women do. But it's a good bet that if somebody has PMS, bad, or PMDD, that they will have some trouble with the hormonal changes that go on during pregnancy. Because really in the first 2 to 4 months, progesterone climbs about 10 to 100 times the normal level. So there's lots of changes that go on. Those neurohormones are just flooding the new mother, the pregnant woman's brain. And some of them are good things. Some of them are making her more vigilant to what's going on around. And the progesterone kind of is a Valium-type feeling, very mellow and this and that. And sometimes you might remember how that felt in your pregnancy. But, you know, right after you deliver, that estrogen level that's really sky high crashes down in 24 hours to your normal rate of your menstrual cycle. And so if you're a woman who's sensitive to hormonal fluctuations, that can cause a big problem. And this basically the presentation, if you're involved with somebody in your life, whether yourself or family members, it's more of an anxious presentation as opposed to a depressed, depressed presentation. We call it postpartum depression, but it's really more anxiety than depression, if you think about it. And a lot of times it's a lot of racing thoughts, agitation, panic attacks, and obsessions, rather than becoming sad and withdrawn. And about 50 to 80% are baby blues, what we call baby blues, and they self-correct within about 2 to 4 weeks with support. So if you know somebody, or if you yourself are in that situation, you need to ask for support in those first 2 to 4 weeks. Our culture is not very good at this. In fact, it's bad at it. I'll say it straight out. Compared to, say, the Asian culture, which I used to see the women coming in from, they would fly in from Asia to come and spend time with their daughter. And she was actually forced to stay in bed. This is what the culture had held, while the mother took care of everything so that the new mother could just chill and get her body back in sync. Even if you're breastfeeding, it's important that the new mother pumps, if nothing else, so that someone else can do the breastfeeding for a few nights a week so she can sleep. Postpartum depression is when those symptoms don't resolve in more than 2 weeks. And that's when you have to start saying, oh, gee, this is not normal anymore. This is very important because some people like just blow it off, but it's not. This is when you're actually running into trouble and you need to get therapy or medication or both. And then there's postpartum psychosis, which occurs in only 1 in 3 women for every 1,000 deliveries. But it can occur as early as 24 hours after delivery, and certainly within the first 2 to 3 weeks, well before a woman is going for her postpartum checkup. Think about it. So it's important that any new mother has somebody who's watching her for any changes in mood, because it is a psychiatric emergency and it does require hospitalization. Well, we're back to this again, and I just want to point out that perimenopause is the time when the conversation starts to stop happening between your hormones, between your ovaries and your brain, and gradually slows down, and it can last anywhere from 7 to 10 years, and then menopause is when you don't have your period for a year, and then you're in menopause. So, and it's not a smooth transition. As you can see, the hormones go up and down and up and down. It's kind of like a sun flare. And these surges really can precipitate a lot of symptoms for women. And the main ones, actually, are irritability, insomnia, and a depressed mood, right? Rather than, the more common complaints that you think about, which would be more of a hot flash. Not everybody has hot flashes. But even anxiety and panic are big problems too during this time period. And during this time, a lot of our organ systems, again, are subject to deterioration. Our heart and blood vessels, our lower urinary tract, our bones, and our brains. So hormones are essential. The key thing is there's a lot of overlap between depression or perimenopause. And you can see in that inner circle the symptoms of low energy, decreased concentration, insomnia, weight gain, decreased libido are all symptoms of both perimenopause and depression. And so a lot of clinicians miss it. So you need to be smart about it. And, giving hormones will treat the hot flashes, the sweats, the vaginal dryness, but it's not going to treat these depressive symptoms. And that is going to require some treatment. And we also know that women who have a history of like bipolar disorder, and maybe they're going along okay, they're being medicated and everything's fine, they hit the perimenopause period, and because their hormones are being totally wrecked up, it throws them into chaos and they start having symptoms and their medications have to be changed. So if you know someone that has bipolar disorder, that's a really important thing to keep in mind. Watch them and watch the mood. Well, I found this on the internet and it cracked me up, so I had to put it up. So ways to know if you have estrogen issues. Everyone around you has an attitude problem. You're adding chocolate chips to your cheese omelet. The dryer has shrunk every last pair of your jeans. Your husband is suddenly agreeing to everything you say. That's scary. You're using your cellular phone to dial up every bumper sticker that says, "How's my driving? Call 1-800. Everyone's head looks like an invitation to batting practice. Everyone seems to have just landed here from outer space. And you're sure that everyone is scheming to drive you crazy. And the ibuprofen bottle is empty, and you bought it yesterday. Well, here's the real list of symptoms. And believe me, there's a lot of them. And those of you who have been there, done that, I'm sure can relate to some of those symptoms. It's important to maintain adequate progesterone levels. And here's some of the reasons why. And I wanted to show you, I have a copy of the thing, but this is one sample of progesterone cream. And it's really important for everyone to consider using a progesterone cream if you're in perimenopause or menopause, even if you've had a hysterectomy. And sometimes women are on an estrogen patch and they're told, oh, you don't need to take progesterone because you don't have a uterus. Well, that's not true, because I told you that everybody is estrogen dominant, no matter what, and you have to correct that problem. So you don't need to do that willy-nilly, but it's really important that you do consider using some type of progesterone replacement. Progesterone, right. The other thing about hormones is it's important to distinguish between thyroid, hyperthyroid, and hypothyroidism when it comes to your mood. And you can see there's a lot of overlap between mood symptoms and thyroid being out of control. So we can't go into all of this, but just know that you should be having your hot thyroid levels checked. There's also a lot of misconception about bioidentical hormones. And bioidentical hormones are not necessarily natural. It refers to the structure that they mimic your actual hormones. And you can get bioidentical hormones that are custom compounded, or you can get them as an FDA-approved drug. And I'm going to pass this list around. And these are drugs that you can get from your actual pharmacy that are bioidentical. So if you choose to use a bioidentical hormone, it does not necessarily have to be coming from a compounding pharmacy, although you can. I just want to say, for those of you who are over 65, there are 2 million of you who suffer from some form of depression. That's huge. And the interesting thing is it often shows itself as insomnia, anorexia, meaning losing your appetite, and fatigue, rather than a depressed mood. And so what happens when you're having these problems? You go to the doctor, right? And sometimes people are not putting two and two together. But there's a lot of depression in older adults, except that it's not part of aging and it should be treated. Also, vitamin D deficiency is associated with low mood and worse cognitive performance. So don't ignore your symptoms. Now again, just to speak quickly here, the exercise is the energy for health. And what I want you to know, and I'm reiterating again from this morning, it doesn't just help your body, but it helps your mind. It increases that BDNF, which is kind of a miracle grow for the brain. It fertilizes your brain. So if you want to help your brain, exercise. And perhaps you've heard the new saying that sitting is the new smoking. Did you hear that? Well, here we are sitting. So I think it's time for us to stand up. So stand up. And when we sit down, everything kind of caves in, right? Our necks jut out and all of that. So what I want you to do is just put your hands behind your back to support your back and tilt yourself back and just kind of stretch out and undo all of that collapsing from sitting. Right? There you go. Don't throw your back out. Make sure you support your back. Okay. It's real important. We spend so many hours sitting every day that to do this. Okay, now I'm going to show you something to do when you're sitting. So sit down again. That was enough. No more standing for now. I want you to sit on the edge of your chair on your tailbone. On your tailbone. And what I want you to do is to just open your chest up and rotate your arms out so your palms are up. And then just pull your feet out to the side and get a wide base and tuck in your tummy. And just breathe. And hold that now for 10 seconds. 1, 2, 3, 4, don't quit, 5, 6, I see you over there, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, relax. You need to do that about 10 times. I'm not going to torture you now. But anyway, this is an actual MRI of a brain of somebody sitting and somebody after they took a 20-minute walk. And it, you know, it's pretty obvious that your brain is working after this 20-minute walk. So don't fall into the trap of sitting. And of course, we're pretty much all acquainted with the different types of exercise, aerobic exercise, strength training, flexibility, balance. But the most important one you're not going to find in too many books, and that is spiritual exercise. We need to grow our faith muscles. And Timothy says, exercise yourself toward godliness. For bodily exercise profits a little, but godliness is profitable for all things. And it's an individual exercise. It's not a group exercise. You catch it? Exercise yourself unto godliness. Learn to focus on appreciation and thankfulness, even during times of frustration and stress, because what the latest research has shown is that thankfulness or gratitude actually leads to joy. You want joy? Be thankful. It doesn't go the other way around. Joy, you would think sometimes that joy would make you thankful. Oh, I'm joyful and now I'm thankful. But in fact, the research shows just the opposite, that thankfulness leads to joy. So, get your priorities straight and get spiritually buff by doing exercise and spending some time in the Word every day. Let's see. It's a discipline, and why do we exercise? To gain the crown. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Verse 25 and 27. That's why we exercise. Quickly on diet and supplements, since we're going into lunch. I don't know how much we can cover on this, but anyway, I'll do my best. I'm sure people have heard about omega-3s. You've heard about it from every angle and every which way. Just know that it's important for your brain and that we're not getting enough of them. There's lots of different sources, and I don't know about you, but I'm not too good about eating my 2 servings of salmon every week, and it has to be wild salmon. Don't be thinking you're going to be buying farm-raised salmon and getting away with it, so, you know, you got to get the expensive stuff. But the alternative is also using flaxseed, and if you add flaxseed to things that you normally eat, like oatmeal or pancakes or other things that you're doing, you can also get what you need. If you need to supplement more, which most people do, and somewhere here I had how many people are not taking enough omega-3s, you need to supplement. And there's regular fish oil, and there's fish oil that has krill oil in it. And krill oil just has some extra ingredients in it that helps to preserve the fish oil and helps to get it to where it needs to go in your body. Then there's a low glycemic diet, and carbohydrates play an important role in our physical health and in our emotional health. And so it's important to have some carbs. I know there's a big push about eating an all-protein diet, but you do need carbs as well. It's important that you eat those that have a lower glycemic index. However, what we've found out recently is that glycemic load is as important, if not more important, than glycemic index. And we have people in nutrition here, and I'm sure they can speak to this way better than I can. But a good example is carrots. And carrots have a very high glycemic index. You can see it's 71, but their glycemic load is only 2 to 4. So that would be an okay food for you to eat. And all of this information is available to you on the internet and other sources. Tryptophan-rich diet is real important because serotonin is critical for your mood and sleep, and niacin is important for your overall health and also to lower your risk of heart problems. But you need tryptophan to use the niacin and the serotonin. And in order to do that, you need riboflavin, iron, and B6. So you need supplementation. Everybody needs supplementation. And there's little evidence to show that supplementation with L-tryptophan really helps. And it is linked with serious side effects. So the third diet, which pretty much everyone's familiar with, is the Mediterranean diet, and it emphasizes the fresh, colorful fruits and vegetables and beans and legumes and so forth, eating with loved ones. And it's an anti-inflammatory diet, and that's why it helps your depression, because depression is often associated with inflammation in our body. It's also rich in the omega-3 fatty acids. Now, many people believe that if we eat a healthy diet, we don't need to take a multivitamin. And I don't know how you feel about it, but it may be true, but only if we eat fresh, you know, not genetically modified food, which has not been transported for months and sitting on a store shelf and all of that. And in fact, even the Journal of the American Medical Association came out with the recommendation that everyone takes a medical grade multivitamin and mineral. The interesting thing is I just read this past week that there was a new release from the New York State Attorney General's office who gave a warning to GNC, Target, Walgreens, and Walmart. I don't know if any of you read that, to pull their store brand stuff off the shelves because it didn't contain what it was supposed to contain. So, and it contained other things that it shouldn't contain. So it's very important that you use a medical grade supplement to get the right nutrients so that you can do what you need to do. And again, B12, somebody mentioned earlier, when you're, especially for those of you over 60, a lot of people have low B12 levels, and you have lack of energy and mental fatigue and mood changes and sleep difficulties. And what happens is you need B12 to make melatonin. So if you don't have the B12, you're not going to make the melatonin. So, you know, it's real important to use that. And if you think you're getting B12 in a multivitamin, it's generally not going to help you because it just can't be absorbed. Only 1/3 of 1% is absorbed for most multivitamins. So a better alternative is to take the B12 in a spray, just like the melatonin. And you'll get it absorbed right into your system. Yeah, or a sublingual pill too, Any something that just goes right into your system is good. Vitamin D, most people have heard a lot about vitamin D and just know that it's important for so many things. We used to just think it was for bones, but it's not. The one thing I wanted to say about that No, I'm saying that later. Okay. Is that we need the frame, the Rotterdam study showed us that in order to utilize calcium to help bone loss prevention, is that we need vitamin K2. I don't know if anybody here takes vitamin K2, but that's an important vitamin to get the calcium into our bones and not in our hearts. We don't want to have hardening of the arteries from calcium. We want to get it in our bones. Okay? And we also need vitamin K1. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. And the other thing is the gut-brain axis with prebiotics and probiotics. You've heard a lot about that too on television and other places about eating yogurts with the probiotics. And prebiotics are the plant fiber that nourishes the good bacteria. But pretty much in order to get what you need, you have to eat quite a bit of yogurt, or you also need to take quite a bit of plant fiber. So it's better to supplement. Important thing to remember is if you do take a probiotic supplement, make sure you refrigerate it, because that bacteria, the good bacteria, will disintegrate quickly. So it needs to be refrigerated. And so the take-home message is, in order to restart your body, address your sleep, your hormone issues, find an exercise routine that you can enjoy and stick with it. Take out some dietary insurance by providing your body with a strong nutritional foundation of diet and supplements. And that's that.
Okay. Any questions? I think